They went to their homeworlds and their battlefields and their mobile headquarters, ready to wage war or flee or surrender. For the Alliance's deadlock remained unbroken, and Mon's speeches had not swayed them. She watched Senator Pamlo's unmarked transport depart for Coruscant, where Pamlo would publicly decry the Death Star battle station before resigning her office and urging the rebellion to disband. Mon had extracted that concession during her 83 minutes of debate with Pamlo that morning. Maybe one day Mon would look back and admire Tinra Pamlo's principles. But not today. She turned back to the hangar, crossed the tarmac, and stepped into the shadows of the ziggurat. A steady trickle of counselors continued to their ships, apparently supervised by David Straven and Antok Merrick. Merrick was by all accounts an excellent pilot and a worthy commander of Blue Squadron. Seeing him with Draven, Mon had to resist the urge to ask, "Who are we assassinating now?" Instead she said, "Are the departures secure?" There was no point worrying at wounds before they'd even scabbed over. "Blue Squadron is ready to launch if anyone calls for assistance," Merrick said. Draven grunted. "Everything's clean so far. At least the Imperials didn't follow anyone here." He glanced from side to side, nodded to an oblivious senator's aide, and lowered his voice. "Even so, I'd like to start scouting new headquarters. Too many people know about Base One, and we can't be sure how many of them will still be on our side tomorrow." Just like that, Mon thought, we're preparing for the breakup of the Alliance. "Do it," she said. Merrick started to speak, but was interrupted by a shout from the rear of the hangar. "Senator! Senator Mothma!" One of the base privates was powering his way past a huddle of technicians and a C-1 series astromech racing toward her. Draven stepped out of their circle to intercept him, grasping his shoulder roughly, as if he were ready to throw the man to the ground. As if, Mon realized, Draven were protecting her from a would-be assassin. She wasn't sure whether to feel grateful or worried. "Stop right there, Private," Draven said, low and stern. The man stood stiff, practically shaking with nervous energy.
"Let him speak," Mon said.
"Intercepted Imperial transmission, ma'am," the private answered.
"Rebels on Scarif."
Scarif? How is that possible? But the answer was obvious. She saw it on Draven's face, too, and Merrick's. While Mon had spent the night clutching like a miser at whatever pieces of the Alliance she might preserve, Jyn Erso had gone to risk everything she had. She fixed the private with a sober look. "I need to speak to Admiral Raddus," she said.
"He's left already."
The man was almost stammering.
"He's in orbit aboard the Profundity. He's gone to fight."
"I see," she said, and slowly smiled. Merrick's expression was expectant, Draven's grave and resolved. Perhaps she had given up hope too swiftly. Less than 10 minutes later, sirens were announcing the departure of red, blue, green, and gold squadrons, along with the U-Wing transports. Raddus had already contacted all capital ships within range of Yavin or Scarif. Draven had brusquely warned Mon not to think of joining the mission, no matter how inspirational she thought she might be. But the warning hadn't been necessary. Mon understood her limits too well to get in the way. Instead, she reminded herself of her pride in the soldiers of the Alliance and watched pilots and infantry personnel and technicians scramble to their vessels. Anyone capable of contributing would find his or her abilities welcome in the coming battle. As the last transports began to fill, she turned back to the corridors of the ziggurat and set out for the communications center. She had to step aside for a gold-plated protocol droid and an astromech unit hurrying toward the tarmac, and faintly overheard the former indignantly declare,
"Scarif? They're going to Scarif? Why does nobody ever tell me anything, R2?
Grand Moff Willef Tarkin made it a point not to dwell on the flamboyant ambitions of Orson Krennic. Over the course of more than a decade, The director had gone from a nuisance to a genuine threat and back again, all the while demanding far more attention than Tarkin was prepared to grant him. Krennic had been too useful to dispose of and too self-motivated to trust. But an admixture of neglect and rare, forceful reminders of Tarkin's authority had kept him largely on the outskirts of Tarkin's personal galaxy. Nonetheless, as Tarkin stood on the overbridge of the Death Star and stared into the stars on the viewscreen, he took a moment to acknowledge the director's contributions. A project of such scale needed to be handled with both an eye for detail and an emphasis on implementation. And Krennic, despite his faults and obsessions, had made the Death Star work. Tarkin had half expected every non-essential system on the battle station to burn out after the test on Jeddah. Yet the Death Star remained intact, invulnerable, its full fury yet to be unleashed. It would be remarkable, Tarkin thought, to see if it could truly demolish a planet. He laughed inwardly at his own childish eagerness. There was no hurry. The Death Star was a tool like any other, to be applied at the appropriate hour.
Sir!
General Ramodi had approached. Tarkin indicated his attentiveness with the cock of his head.
Scarif Base. They're reporting a rebel ground incursion. Firefights around the Citadel.
Now that was a surprise. Scarif was a hardened target. One saw Guerrera might have struck while feeling particularly ambitious. If the rebellion was hitting Scarif so soon after Guerrera's death, it was for a reason. Possibilities flitted across Tarkin's mind. None of them alarmed him. Very little truly alarmed Tarkin anymore.
A ground incursion, he said. But no space-borne support?
Not that Ramdas people mentioned, which suggested a last-gasp effort or a plan not yet fully implemented.
I want to speak to Director Krennic, Tarkin said.
He's there, sir,
Ramodi replied.
On Scarif. The day was full of surprises. Tarkin spoke with detached consideration, as much to himself as Ramodi.
The original plans for the station are kept at the Citadel, are they not?
They are.
Along with other technical schematics for projects covered by the Tarkin Initiative. It would be a special pity, Tarkin thought, to see War Mantle and Stellar Sphere set back, but hardly a major blow to the galactic timetable, particularly with the Death Star finally online. Best to suffer a minor loss to avoid a greater one. What the rebels could do with the technical schematics was limited, of course, but Tarkin had always been a man who preferred to elude the specter of risk.
Prepare the jump to hyperspace, he said, and inform Lord Vader.
Ramodi hurried off, and the soft hum of the reactor rose gently in pitch as the lightspeed engines drained away power. Tarkin folded his hands together and observed a pair of TIE fighters on the viewscreen race toward one of the station's hangar bays. He was curious to see the rebels in action. He was curious, too, what opportunities might present themselves. Just how many victories might be scored in one battle? But Tarkin was a patient man. He would wait and see what Scarif provided.
Supplemental data. The Rebel Fleet.
Document number MH2215. Short notes on the history of the Rebel Alliance Navy. From the personal files of Mon Mothma. The Clone Wars redefined interstellar conflict, forcing us to grapple with realities we'd blessedly forgotten after generations of peace. This was, perhaps, the very worst of the war's crimes. They ushered in an age when mass bloodshed was no longer unthinkable, but rather an essential feature of military action. I've argued that our rebel movement is not a response to the political question of the Clone Wars, and I continue to believe this. Nonetheless, No one can claim that our military doctrine is not largely defined by the desire and need to do things differently. What worked in the Clone Wars cannot work again. The partnership of Jedi Knights and Kaminoan clone armies constituted a peerless weapon that no longer exists. Consider a brigade of clone troopers served by a Jedi commander. Such a unit might penetrate a world's orbital defenses and seize control of the entire planet while taking and inflicting minimal casualties. I do not mean to understate the role of naval warfare during the last conflict, nor to denigrate the sacrifices of starship pilots and crew who were lost. But what blockade could be thorough enough to keep out a handful of determined starfighters and a single clone dropship? Yes, such blockades existed, and in greater numbers toward the conflict's end. But their cost helped to fracture and bankrupt the nascent separatist government. With the Clone Wars' end, the destruction of the Jedi Order, and the decommissioning of the Kaminoan cloning facilities, the self-proclaimed Emperor and his military advisors determined that the future of warfare was in large-scale naval weaponry, in a fleet of battleships and battle stations that could atomize any enemy, whether on a planet's surface or among the stars. They rebuilt a military not for precision strikes, but for hammer blows. A military that could counter the interstellar movement of any mobile infantry that an uprising might field. This was the vile genius of Emperor Palpatine's plan. He knew a rebellion like ours would have no difficulty assembling a vast army of ground troops from thousands of oppressed worlds. But his stormtroopers could curtail a local uprising's growth on any single world, and his fleets could decimate spaceborne troops during an attempted landing. No potential rebellion could dare eschew infantry altogether, but lacking the elite support of Jedi or clones, the cost in lives would be abominable. See, for example, the affair of the 61st Mobile Infantry at Ferrick Pax, thus the importance of the Rebel Navy. While the Empire constructed its behemoth Star Destroyers and its TIE Fighter Swarms, another fleet was forming in less mechanistic fashion. In the early years of what would become our rebellion, there was little coordination among insurgent cells, yet each on its own understood the need to obtain starships for military strikes and transport. A retooled freighter here, augmented with illegal weapons salvaged from separatist wrecks. A pirate corvette there, donated by a sympathetic underworld contact. A handful of starfighters, stolen in a daring raid on an Imperial base. As insurgent factions in different sectors began to coordinate and share resources, new challenges arose. One TIE fighter is little different from another. Its mechanisms and its pilots can be swapped with ease when repairs or injuries warrant. Not so with the variety of ships flying for the rebel cause. Staffing and maintaining a patchwork fleet is a task that under less expert leadership, I do not include myself, should have been impossible. Rebel captains proposed a threefold solution to our challenge. First, an underground pipeline was to be established through which both smugglers and legitimate merchants would obtain and distribute badly needed starship parts. This distribution network would need to rival those of some of the Republic's larger corporations to operate effectively. The assistance of former separatist advisors would ultimately prove invaluable. Second, pilots would be encouraged to coordinate and learn from one another and to train on as many types of ships and simulators as possible. This would not only allow skilled pilots to be placed on new vessels should their personal spacecraft be destroyed, but also prove vital for multi-ship engagements. As Admiral Raddus puts it, no one wants to fly in formation with a stranger. Third, rebel leadership would expend whatever resources were required to obtain additional starfighter squadrons. These efforts would cost credits and lives, and the details must remain confidential for now. Nonetheless, our access to X-Wing fighters in particular is testament to our success. As our rebellion gained visibility, new opportunities arose as well. The arrival of the Mon Calamari city ships was a shocking, and perhaps given a limited effectiveness against the occupation of Mon Cava, undeserved boon, emphasizing the significance of winning the hearts of the galaxy's civilians above all else. Over time, leaders like Radus and General Merrick performed a startling feat, transforming what might have amounted to a pirate armada into a genuine fighting force. We've long since known that our pilots, crews, and commanders can easily match the skill and bravery of their Imperial counterparts. What remains to be tested is whether our vessels can engage in a full-scale fleet battle and triumph against a technologically superior opponent. My hope is that such a test is never needed. But if the day does come, I believe we will emerge victorious.
Chapter 18.
Bodhi Rook should have felt guilty. From inside the cockpit of shuttle SW-0608, he watched black smoke rise from half a dozen landing pads, the sort of smoke that spilled like blood from a crashed cargo ship or a burning speeder. He'd seen Saw Gerrera's rebels blow up installations before. He recognized himself in the black-clad figures that raced to extinguish fires or who took cover behind patrolling stormtroopers. Bodhi had never thought of himself as a soldier or a killer. He should have felt guilty. But he'd picked a side when Galen Erso had told him of the crimes he was enabling. He'd felt his last doubts burn away in the fire that had consumed Jetta City.
Troopers!
It was Corporal Tonk's voice, from down the cockpit ladder and outside the ship.
Troopers on the left!
Bodhi heard boots ring against deck plating as the five rebel fighters who'd stayed with the shuttle hurried inside. Through the viewport, he spotted a squad of stormtroopers racing across the landing pad, sprinting past cargo crates and control consoles. None of them gave the shuttle more than a glance. For the moment, at least, Bodhi could keep hiding. Tonk scrambled noisily up the cockpit ladder, the barrel of his shoulder-slung rifle striking each rung as he went. Bodhi tried to look confident, tough in the man's presence. Tonk had spent most of the flight to Scarif interrogating Bodhi before volunteering to guard the shuttle. Bodhi still wasn't sure what the corporal thought of him. Tonk struck Bodhi with the flat of his hand, square between the shoulders.
"How are we doing up here?"
he growled. Bodhi winced at the force of the blow. "Looks like they've grounded non-combat vessels, but overall they're ignoring the shuttles. I can't really tell what's going on." He gestured vaguely at the viewport in the smoke. Occasionally he made out the crimson flash of a blaster bolt, but the trees obscured his view of the pads, bunkers, and barracks closer to the citadel.
"What's going on is fighting," Tonk said. "That's the Pathfinders for you."
Bodhi was adjusting his instruments, head down over his console, but the admiration in Tonk's voice caught his attention.
"I thought you were a Pathfinder," he asked.
Tonk laughed.
"I can't do half what those Spec Force guys do. But I heard Captain Andor needed volunteers, so I volunteered."
His voice took on a gruffer quality as he added,
"Still a better shot than you."
Bodhi didn't doubt that. The comm crackled and a voice came through, urgent and angry.
"Pad 12! Close it down!"
Bodhi slapped his thighs in triumph.
"I found the main security channel. We can track their movements from here."
Tonk pursed his lips and nodded approvingly. The chatter was fast and overlapping. The Citadel demanded status reports and assessments of rebel troop numbers, while stormtroopers called for emergency reinforcements.
"We have rebels everywhere!"
one voice called, and Bodhi couldn't help but smile.
"We're just going to sit here and be smug? Or are you going to help out?"
Tonk asked. Bodhi bristled, but the words were more friendly than challenging. He reached for the comm controls again and bit his lip. Baze and Chirrut were out there,
probably shooting and getting shot at, along with all the rebel soldiers. Cassian and Jin and K2 were inside the Citadel by now. If everything went well, even if everything went perfectly, not everyone would make it back alive. They weren't his friends. They hadn't gone drinking with Bodhi after his crush on Bamayar had rejected him, or helped him reassemble his astromech after he'd stupidly taken the droid apart on a dare. But they had saved him from Saw Gerrera, believed him when Saw and his people hadn't. They'd never once put him in cuffs. They'd needed him on Edu, and never once pretended they hadn't. They wanted to stop the Death Star. They didn't deserve to be hurt. Bodhi should have felt guilty. You don't have to feel guilty. He punched a button, lifted the link, and shouted into the open comm.
Pad 2! This is Pad 2! We count 40 rebel soldiers running west off Pad 2!
Then he muted the comm and adjusted the settings with one shaking hand. He felt a rush of energy, terrifying and invigorating, as he passed the link to Tonk. "Tell them you're pinned down by rebels on Pad 5," he said. Tonk grinned broadly and took the link.
"Who needs Spec Force?" he asked. "We can do this all by ourselves."
For an instant, Bodhi felt sure that was true, but he was glad not to be fighting alone. Jin's fears had begun to multiply. In the starkly revealing light of the cave in her mind, she seemed to find another with every moment that passed. Fear for her companions and the danger they were in. Fear for how she might fail or abandon them. Fear of what the Death Star would do if not stopped. Fear of failing to deliver the redemption her father sought. It was fear that guided her hand to her blaster as she walked with Cassian and K2 down a Citadel sub-corridor and saw 30 stormtroopers rush toward her in formation. It was fear that made her eager for a fight, eager to channel her dread into pitiless blows and the pain of bruised ribs. Edu and Jedha had given her numbing solace in the form of endless marches and racking storms and sunlight gone cold. Scarif's comforts let her think too much. And when the stormtrooper platoon passed by without a glance, footsteps in sync as they made for the main entrance to the Citadel, she couldn't help but feel disappointed.
"Guess our distraction's working,"
Cassian murmured. Jin forced herself to look approving.
"It was a good plan."
They hadn't heard from Melshi or the others since the detonators had gone off. The rebels were supposed to signal if they had anything Jin or Cassian needed to know. Unless, of course, they all died.
"Stay focused, Jin."
She tried to remember how she'd kept radio silent during runs for Saw. How she'd managed to wait back at base for comrades like Maya and Staven to return. But the vague, inchoate memories made her feel ill. And even then, she hadn't needed those people the way she needed Bodhi and the Guardians and Cassian. To keep her on task. To keep her from just surviving.
"Stay focused and do your damn job."
"This way to the data vault," K2 said.
They moved as swiftly as they could without drawing attention. The corridors emptied while they traveled, officers withdrawing to their stations and troopers racing for the perimeter. At last, they reached a heavy blast door.
"Inside."
The door opened without a code. The antechamber to the vault was as starkly appointed as the rest of the facility. A single squat lieutenant sat behind a console, guarding entry into a brightly illuminated tube ringed with devices Jin didn't recognize.
"Can I help you?" the lieutenant asked.
"That won't be necessary,"
K2 replied, and brought a metal fist down onto the man's skull. The lieutenant slumped onto the console as the droid maneuvered around him, shoving the unconscious body aside and plugging into a data port. Cassian rushed to drag the man out of view of the doorway. Jin stood in the circular frame of the tube, blinking at the light and peering at the massive vault door at the far end. A long-forgotten recollection of a bad night in the crawl space of an Imperial treasury flashed in her mind. She could still feel the sparks burning on her cheeks,
the calluses from 4 hours working a plasma cutter. Carving through the metal, she decided, wasn't an option.
How does it open? She called.
Biometric identification. Lieutenant Patna should do.
K2 gestured absently at the body in Cassian's arms.
I must remain here.
What for?
Cassian asked. Jin repositioned herself to help grapple the unconscious lieutenant, lifting his legs as Cassian hoisted him beneath the shoulders.
No data tape can be removed from the vault without authorization and assistance from this console. In this way, any single would-be thief is denied success. In the event of a security breach, the screening tunnel can also be energized to wipe all data storage. I prefer to keep my memory intact.
Jin craned her neck as Cassian led the way down the tube. The rings of equipment seemed no less threatening, even knowing they were designed to thwart electronics instead of people. Cassian grunted at Jin. She dropped the lieutenant's legs, and Cassian rolled the man over, slapping his hand against the scanner and the vault door. For several seconds, nothing happened. Then a short, low buzz indicated rejection of the scan. Jin swore to herself and felt her skin prickle with heat.
It's not working!
Cassian called. K2's voice came echoing through the tunnel.
Right hand!
You're a terrible spy!
Jin hissed. She was surprised by her own intensity, the easy jibe laced with frustration. Cassian ignored her and rearranged the body. The vault door chimed swiftly this time. Metal lock disengaged and a current of vibration ran through the floor. Slowly, excruciatingly slowly, the door opened. For the better part of 5 minutes, the rebels held the advantage. The stormtroopers who survived the initial detonations were stunned, deafened, blinded, injured by the blasts and thunder and shrapnel. They did not panic. They raced dutifully to their posts and clustered their shots in well-timed volleys. But they were scrambling to compensate for casualties before they had even spotted the enemy. They were easy to kill and easy to herd. Baze took satisfaction in the cries of alarm and the tumbling of bodies as his companions caught Imperial squads in particle barrages. He took no less satisfaction each time Chirrut emerged from the shadows to send a stormtrooper sprawling, or when his own meticulous cannon shots burst through one suit of armor after the next. Baze had heard once, he could not recall from whom, that the Jedi considered anger an abomination. A path to what they called the dark side of the Force. But the Guardians of the Wills were not Jedi, and Baze's anger was righteous, able to guide his shots where the Force would not. And if anger had not sufficed to save the Holy City, then Baze would need to be twice as fierce on Scarif to give Jin Erso the distraction she required. Baze, Chirrut, and the rebels swarmed and regrouped, separated the squads of their enemies, and picked off the reinforcements who arrived one by one. But soon the stormtroopers regained their strength, and the reinforcements came by tens and twenties. That was when the rebels began to die. Baze did not know their names. He did not hear their wails over the endless reverberations of blaster bolts and the lower thrumming of his cannon. He left smoking bodies behind as he fell back. The fallen would not receive proper death rites, but Baze decided that if anyone lived through the day, he would honor the dead with his fellow survivors. The air smelled like ashes. It was better than the tang of sea salt. Squads of stormtroopers crept away from the barracks, forming a spearhead aimed at the hillock where the rebels were attempting to hold ground. Baze saw the opportunity when Melshi did. One brief chance to break the enemy. And as Melshi cried, "Forward!" Baze provided cover for the rebels to shatter the spearhead. An allied rocket blasted armored bodies through the air. Then the moment was gone. And as one, the rebels scampered into the cover of the jungle, allowing the stormtroopers to give chase. In the relative shade of the trees, Baze's eyes spotted with streaks of color as blaster volleys flashed by.
His back had begun to ache from the weight of his generator, and sweat plastered his beard to his chin. He did not stop moving until he realized, with a start, that he had not seen Chirrut in some moments. He spat a curse, spun about, and fired at a stormtrooper over the head of a rebel half-crawling through the underbrush. If he yelled for the blind man now, a dozen guns would be aimed his way. But if he'd lost Chirrut... The smoke was everywhere. Trees burned as their trunks absorbed bolt after bolt. Bayes stalked back the way he had come, concentrating his focus, narrowing his cone of vision as if sheer intensity would allow him to penetrate the haze.
Bayes! Bayes!
He heard Chirrut before he saw him. The blind man's robes were marred with soot and soil, and his expression was wild with alarm, but he appeared uninjured. Bayes felt a rush of fury and an equal rush of relief.
What? He snapped. What is it?
Run, Chirrut said.
Run!
With those words, as Chirrut grasped Bayes by the arm and pulled him toward the shoreline, Bayes' senses expanded again. He heard the heavy snapping of wood. Not burning wood, not wood ravaged by a grenade, but the broad-leafed trees of the jungle being compressed beneath an unfathomable weight until they broke and burst. He turned and saw the towering metal forms of Imperial walkers on the march. Their legs dwarfed the trees, and the laser cannons attached to their cockpits pumped ruin toward the scattering rebel soldiers. The stormtroopers had slowed their pursuit, staying out of the crossfire as they attempted to cut off the rebels' routes to escape. The rebels had already begun to die, but death was not failure. Failure lay in the shadow of the metal beasts.
Go, little sister, Bayes thought. Go!
Dozens of vessels winked into existence against the shroud of space, filling the void as if some mythological deity had upturned a bottle of fresh stars over the heavens. Admiral Raddus, Raddus of Mon Cala, Raddus of the Flows, Raddus of the Clutch of Zetasur and the Spear of Trifar, knew many of the ships by their silhouettes. X-Wing and Y-Wing starfighters, U-Wing and Gallo-free transports, Dornian gunships and Hammerhead corvettes. All of them had served the rebellion well. It was a tremendous sight, unique in the history of the rebellion. If the fleet had a vulnerability, it was that self-same uniqueness.
We fight as siblings who have never known a shared home, Raddus thought. Against an empire that knows naught but tyrannical discipline.
Raddus did not avert his gaze from the main display as he gestured to his comm officer.
Are all capital ships accounted for?
Yes, Admiral,
came the answer in that rasping human voice. Raddus had yet to adjust to keeping aliens aboard his bridge, no matter how skilled. The Profundity had been built by Mon Calamari and only recently refitted for war by the Rebellion. With the refit had come unexpected diversity.
Very good. And General Merrick!
The General's proud bellow came through the comm with a burst of static.
Ready to fight, Admiral! Sending possible attack runs now!
There was a brief pause before the voice continued.
This is Blue Leader. All squadron leaders report in!
Raddus turned from the viewport to the tactical holo displays, scanning the battlefield as the squadron leaders replied.
Blue Leader, this is Gold Leader. Red Leader standing by.
Green Leader standing by!
The Profundity had detected, and its crew or its allies had visually confirmed, two Star Destroyers, at least 9 distinct TIE Starfighter squadrons, and innumerable mid-sized vessels ranging from shuttles to patrol cruisers, all situated between the Rebels and Scarif. Other enemy craft, as yet undetected, could have been hidden behind planets and moons or running dark on auxiliary power. On its own, the Imperial fleet would pose a formidable challenge, but not a dispiriting one. Yet Scarif's planetary defenses were considerable. Draven's spies had reported an energy shield built to withstand massive bombardment. and the orbital gate station appear to be festooned with turrets and starfighter hangars. Combined with the Imperial fleet, the battle would be, at the very least, memorable. For all that, the decimation of the Alliance Navy was the least of Radus's concerns. On Yavin 4, Jyn Erso had described a battle station capable of destroying whole worlds. Radus had never known the Empire to be restrained in its use of weapons, and of all the planets in its grasp, he could think of few as defiant as his own homeworld. Mon Cala had resisted. Mon Cala had been punished. Mon Cala had, time and again, offered its warriors and resources to the rebellion. If the rebellion failed to stop the Death Star, Mon Cala would be obliterated. For this reason, and for 100 others, Radus would fight as long as the profundity endured. General Ramda was a fool, and Krennic had already decided to have him tried and imprisoned for gross incompetence. Still, there was no one on Scarif whom Krennic trusted to replace him, and Krennic himself knew too little of the Citadel's vulnerabilities. So he allowed the general to race about the command center while Krennic seethed, listening to cries and reports from troopers in the field. Krennic was not at heart a military man. He believed that if a battle had to be waged, something had already gone wrong. The enemy's numbers at first seemed impossibly strong, surely a product of confusion and disarray, but no less obfuscating for all that. Yet as the fighting proceeded, no breaches in the base's defenses were reported, and the conflict remained at some distance from the Citadel Tower. Soon, a lieutenant shouted triumphantly and declared that walkers had routed the rebels and pushed them to the shore. Krennic had no words of praise for the officers of Scarif, but this was enough to dampen his ire. The data vault was pristine. The Citadel was safe. The Jedi survivors would be sifted as ashes from the sand. Again, he tried to recall the face of his attacker on Edu. Had it been a woman? Would he recognize her if the troopers cataloged the dead? He'd give the order to sort the bodies once the battle was over. And he would interrogate any captives himself. If they were Galen's revenge, he would learn the truth. One of Ramda's aides signaled the general.
"Transmission from Admiral Gorin!"
he called. Krennic watched Ramda hurry to a console and tap frantically at the screen. When Ramda approached Krennic, his jaw was set to defy a fresh terror.
"Sir,"
Ramda said, "part of the rebel fleet has arrived from hyperspace and amassed outside the shield. However, the Admiral believes they are no threat to the planet."
"They aren't trying to take the planet,"
Krennic snapped. He would have struck the man if he hadn't needed Ramda so. "Lock down the base.
Lock down everything!"
he was shouting full bore into the general's face. Ramda stood, his breath hitching, but otherwise unaffected.
"And close the shield?"
he asked.
"Do it!"
Krennic roared, and Ramda and his men scurried to act. When the orders had been given, Krennic lowered his voice but still heard himself quivering with fury.
"Is there any way," he asked,
"that the rebel fleet can break through the shield? Think before you answer."
"The shield gate itself," Ramda said with deliberate care, "is the only weak point. With massive amounts of firepower, an enemy could conceivably punch through the field contained by the ring. But Admiral Gorin is positioning his ships to prevent even that unlikely occurrence."
Krennic nodded briskly and waved Ramda off. He fought down his blinding rage and updated his reconstruction of the attack. A team of rebels had infiltrated the planet somehow in an attempt to penetrate the Citadel and steal the Death Star schematics. When the attack had gone poorly, the rebels had brought in their fleet. If not in its entirety, then an irreplaceable force, fighting a battle they couldn't possibly hope to win. Was it an act of true desperation? Had some rebel commander decided that it was worth losing everything for even a chance at extracting the team seeking the plans? There was logic in it, given certain premises. The Death Star was an existential threat to the Alliance. If the rebels believed, if Galen had made them believe, there was a weakness in the station, then they were taking the only conceivable path to avoid doom. It hadn't occurred to Krennic that the rebels might sacrifice so many lives for such an unlikely gain. He'd known they were individually suicidal. A mass death wish was something new. He slammed a fist onto the nearest console and ignored the frightened looks of the officers. You must have told quite a story, Galen.
This is Admiral Raddus. Red and Gold Squadrons, engage those two Star Destroyers. Blue Squadron, get to the surface before they close that gate!
Merrick's answer crackled through the comm on the bridge of the Profundity.
Copy you, Admiral.
Raddus pressed his palms together and let his mouth hang open, allowing the thick, artificially humid air to condense inside his mouth and throat. Then he wet his lips and barked new orders to his crew.
I want one-third of the fleet each, supporting Red and Gold Squadrons. That should force those destroyers to engage. The remainder will protect our flank. When the Empire brings in reinforcements, I don't want our escape route cut off.
It was an almost simplistic plan, cobbled together from skirmishes at Nexator and Carsanza, but there was no time to compose anything more elaborate. This was an opening gambit, not a strategy to win the day. And improvisation had always been one of Raddus's talents.
What about Profundity, Admiral? The tactical officer called. We cover Blue Squadron,
Raddus said, and jetted a finger at the viewport.
We target the shield gate!
The battle was joined, and chaos ensued. Raddus moved his attention calmly, surely, between the tactical holo displays in the viewport. The former revealed the state of the battlefield, the latter revealed its timbre. He saw the motes of light signifying Blue Squadron bearing toward the shield gate, and he saw the first wild emerald volleys unleashed by the Star Destroyers, spattering and rippling against the deflectors of rebel hammerheads. He said nothing during the opening moments of violence. He trusted his gunners and his captains to swim as the tide demanded. Barely aware of his own motions, he rose from his seat and crept toward the viewport as the shield gate came into full view. The iridescent flicker of energy outside the ring had begun to diminish, as, like water in a river lock, the gate regulated the energy flow and permitted the gap in the shield to close. It would take only moments before the shield was fully reestablished. A wave of Blue Squadron fighters and U-Wing transports hurtled toward the closing gate, flashing through before entering Scarif's atmosphere. A second wave continued forward, and Raddus heard a panicked cry through the comm station.
Pull up!
A single starfighter vanished in a burst of sparks and metal, battered into oblivion against the energy shield. The first Alliance loss of the battle. Raddus turned back to the tactical displays. Jyn Erso and her colleagues, Rogue One, had their ground support. But delivering Blue Squadron had been the simple part. Now things would become more difficult. The walkers stalked the rebels like hunting hounds, relentless and unafraid. Their blasts splintered trees and showered bays with burning dirt and sand. They did far worse to the soldiers struck with any precision. A quick death, Baze thought, did not make a good death. He emerged with Chirrut and the dozen rebel survivors onto the beach, racing along the shores. The mechanical grinding of walker legs drowned out the ragged gasps of his breathing, the beat of his boots on sand. A long trench ran near the water, built by the stormtroopers, he supposed, to help repel an invasion by sea. And one after the next, the rebels leapt or swung inside, as if a mound of sand would stop the walkers for a fraction of an instant.
then? If a fraction of an instant was all Baze had left to give Jyn Erso, it was better than no gift at all. Besides, he had nowhere else to run. He scrambled into the trench near Chirrut and didn't pause to glance toward the walkers before dropping his cannon and seizing a rocket launcher from a rebel who hastily passed the weapon his way. If he aimed well, he might be able to shatter one walker's cockpit, kill or expose the pilot, damage its controls, make the vehicle useless. He would not have the time or the ammunition for a second shot, but he might earn the rebels a few instants more before the other walker buried them all. He rose from the trench, turned to face the foremost walker, maybe 50 meters distant now, at the edge of the tree line. He set the launcher on his shoulder, lined up a shot while the rebels alongside him fired blasters uselessly. His body lurched as the rocket leapt forward, soaring toward the terrible machine. The explosion nearly deafened him. Fire and smoke streamed from one side of the walker's cockpit, and the machine twisted its head away as if in pain. One of its temple-mounted cannons was a wreck, but Baze's aim had not been true. The walker was not disabled. It turned back toward the soldiers. Death had chased Baze for a long time. He bared his teeth at it in defiance. The burning walker targeted the trench. Before it could fire, the sky above Baze wailed and a shadow crossed the sea. Pulses of light, hotter and faster than the rocket, impacted the walker's cockpit, and a second blast of fire tore the mechanical head asunder, sent sheets of smoking metal tumbling through the air and onto the beach. As the walker's body began to topple, its attackers sped above it and over the green of the jungle. An X-Wing starfighter. The Alliance had come to fight after all. Baze's comrades were cheering, raising fists in the air and shouting in triumph. To his surprise, he heard himself laughing with them.
Chapter 19.
The data vault was unlocked. Jyn wanted nothing more than to rush inside, to snatch the tape containing the Death Star schematics, and race back to Bodhi and the shuttle. Every moment they delayed was another chance for the Imperials to catch them inside the Citadel. And out on the beaches and in the jungles, people were surely dying by now. How many rebels were even left? How many stormtroopers could they hold off? Would anyone have told her if Baze and Chirrut were gone? Instead, Jyn was helping Cassian drag the unconscious lieutenant out of the screening tunnel and back to the antechamber, in case there's another biometric lock on the console. Cassian had muttered, "I don't want K2 to have to unplug." He was sweating under his officer's cap, and she'd seen him reach reflexively for his comlink more than once. He wanted to know what was happening outside as much as she did. They dropped the body roughly by K2, still linked to the console port.
"I've accessed internal Citadel communications. The Rebel fleet has arrived."
"What?" Jyn shook her head in confusion.
"Admiral Gorin has engaged them,"
the droid went on, as if reading from a list.
"There's fighting on the beach. They've locked down the base. They've closed the shield gate. They've alerted..."
"Wait, what does that mean?" Jyn cut him off, trying to comprehend the implications to sort positive from negative. "They've closed the shield gate. We're trapped?" She looked to Cassian. His expression was grim, his mouth tight. It was answer enough for her. She swore under her breath, a parade of every obscenity she'd ever heard uttered. She saw the walls of the cave closing in, darkness creeping at the edges of the bright hope that had brought her this far. She racked her brain for a plan and found nothing. Locked down or not, they could find a way out of the Citadel, but if they had no way off Scarif...
"We have to tell them we're down here," she spat. "We're close!"
"They wouldn't be here," Cassian said, "if they didn't know." Jyn leaned in close enough to smell the cleaning chemicals on his Imperial uniform. "Last we saw those people, They didn't want to be here at all. I'm not giving them an excuse to leave. And if they've got a way to get us out, I'd like to know.
Cassian held his ground, staring down at her, until his lips finally twitched into something like a smile. His eyes remained hard and troubled. Jin wasn't sure if he'd gotten worse at hiding things, or if she was simply getting to know him too well. She was ready to call him on it, to ask what he knew that she didn't, when K2 interrupted.
We could transmit the plans to the rebel fleet. We'd have to get a signal out to tell them it's coming. It's the size of the data files. That's the problem. They'll never get through. Someone has to take the shield gate down.
Cassian brought his comlink up. Bodhi. Bodhi, can you hear me? The moment of reflection, of confusion, was over. He was all tense action again.
Tell me you're out there. Bodhi!
Be alive, Jin thought. All of you. Be alive.
I'm here!
Bodhi's voice came through, rapid and short of breath.
We're standing by. They started fighting. The base is on lockdown.
I know, Cassian said.
Listen to me. The rebel fleet is up there. You've got to get a message out.
He squeezed his eyes shut, mouthed something to himself, and then spoke aloud again.
You've got to tell them they've got to blow a hole in the shield gate so we can transmit the plans.
I can't!
Bodhi sounded aghast.
I'm not tied into the comm tower. We're not tied in.
Find a way.
Cassian cut off his link and pocketed it.
Good enough? He asked Jin.
Good enough, she agreed. Maybe it was, and maybe it wasn't. But she tried to pretend the arrival of the fleet was good news. Their escape plan hadn't exactly been foolproof before. And if the Alliance couldn't punch through Scarif Shield, what hope did it have against a Death Star? If nothing else, someone was finally on their side. Cassian looked between the door to the antechamber and K2. Cover our backs, he told the droid, and started toward the screening tunnel. Jin pictured stormtroopers rushing inside and spotting the body of the unconscious lieutenant. Out of instinct more than reason, she pulled the sidearm she'd taken from the lieutenant out of her belt, checked its readings, fully charged, no stun setting, hard to work wrong, and held it grip first toward K2.
You'll need this, she said. You wanted one, right?
K2 snatched the blaster with a disconcerting eagerness. His other hand remained plugged into the console as he turned the weapon about and placed a finger on the trigger. He kept the barrel pointed at the ceiling.
Your behavior, Jin Erso, is continually unexpected.
I couldn't ask for a nicer compliment, she wanted to say. But she decided she could do without the inevitable correction.
Jin.
Cassian stood framed in the entrance of the screening tunnel.
Come on.
She flashed a vicious grin at the droid and went to steal what she'd come for. Bodhi hadn't cheered when the Alliance had arrived. He'd managed a sickly little smile for Tonk's sake, but he'd known immediately how the Empire would respond. By the time X-Wings were blazing over the jungle and U-Wings were delivering Spec Force troops to the beach, the shield gate had already closed. There was no way off Scarif. He didn't blame the rebellion, but that gave Bodhi little solace. Maybe it was his fault for not suggesting an infiltration of the orbital gate station. Maybe he'd explained the planet's defenses poorly to Jin and Cassian and the soldiers, hurrying through it all in the excitement of the flight to Scarif. Maybe he should have been up there instead of down here. Or maybe Cassian was right, and they had to tell their new allies exactly what they needed, somehow. The technical details swam in Bodhi's mind as he climbed down the cockpit ladder. They were a distraction, a welcome distraction from what he was about to do. Though the sounds of distant explosions and blaster fire from outside and the angry shouts of Imperial troops from the comm were equally distracting and far less welcome, Tonk and the others were spread around the cabin with their weapons aimed at the boarding ramp.
but they looked his way as he hurried to the equipment hold.
All right, Bodhi said. Listen up.
Breathe deep and sound like a flight instructor. We're going to have to go out there. He wasn't afraid the rebels would refuse. He was afraid they wouldn't believe him. And afraid of dying, of course. He knelt by the hold and started sorting gear, hoping for the best. He needed KS-12 cable, or anything L-series with a connection adapter. A signal booster, if he could find one. A multi-tool for the hookup.
What are you doing? Tonk asked.
Bodhi hauled a spool of cable out and grimaced at the weight. He set it aside and forced himself to face Tonk. They closed the shield gate, he said. We're stuck here. Tonk knew that much already, but it meant Bodhi could delay the rest a little longer. But the rebel fleet is pulling in. We just have to get a signal strong enough to get through to them and let them know we're trapped down here.
Fine, Tonk said. I won't complain about planning a rescue. But why do you need to go out there?
The emphasis wasn't lost on Bodhi. He just ignored it.
For that? He said. To get a signal out with the shield gate shut? We need to connect to the communications tower. That's the whole point of the thing. To let the Citadel keep talking to the rest of the Empire without opening the defenses.
A deep breath. Now, I can patch us in over here, out on the landing pad. If I'm not cut down on the crossfire or crushed by a falling starfighter. But you have to get on the radio, get one of the guys out there to find a master switch. Tonk was staring at him, evidently torn between duty and bewilderment. He opened his mouth and Bodhi spoke over him, answering the question Tonk was least likely to ask. You don't build a comm tower just anyone can access. There's mechanical, physical connections controlled by the switches, and the switches are like the data vault, totally off the computer network. I only know all this because... But he realized the last time he thought of those days was in the lair of Bor Gullet, and he hurried on.
Get one of the soldiers, Baze or Chirrut, someone, to activate the connection between us and that comm tower.
Otherwise, we're not going anywhere, and that data tape stays on Scarif, okay? Tonk stiffened, suddenly sure of himself. He glanced to the other rebels in the cabin, who offered curt nods of acknowledgement.
Then go! Bodhi cried. Call them!
Before anyone could answer, he was pocketing the tools and heaving the spool over his shoulders, where it could be harnessed like a backpack. Shifting the weight awkwardly, Bodhi hurried to the boarding ramp and peered around the doorway onto the landing pad. He could hear Tonk behind him, talking through his comlink.
Malshi, listen up! You guys have to open up the line!
He couldn't see blaster fire, but then he couldn't see very far at all. The landing pad was cluttered with cargo crates and substations, and the shuttle's undercarriage blocked much of his view. He could smell so much smoke, like the whole jungle was burning. The network console you need is only 10 meters out, maybe 20. You run, you hook up the cable, you head back. Think of it like a race. You used to bet a lot on racing. He wanted to ask Tonk to do it, but Tonk couldn't adjust the connector if something went wrong. Wouldn't know how to run a diagnostic. And Tonk wasn't dressed like an Imperial pilot. That might buy Bodhi an extra minute or two. He had to go. He'd risked his life before, just never quite like this. The rebellion needed him. Jin needed him. Her father, who'd set him on this path, needed him. He braced his legs and got ready to run.
What does it look like?
Tonk called, and Bodhi's urgent determination was shattered. He straightened, looked back at Tonk in confusion. Tonk was holding up his comlink.
The master switch, he said. What's it look like? Where is it?
Bodhi tried not to choke on a laugh and stepped back inside, tugging at the straps of the cable pool.
Let me talk to Melshi, he said.
Apparently, he had a few more moments to dread his mission.
An X-wing pilot dashed against the shield gate. was among the first to die above Scarif. But fatalities mounted rapidly after that. First one starfighter at a time, and then by the dozen. Vadis watched, cold as the waters of his homeland, as a rebel gunship was reduced by turbolaser fire to a spreading globule of molten metal. A great commander, Radis believed, felt each loss among his people, but did not